Thank you, Rabbi Stolish, for that generous introduction. And I hope when I ducked out in the middle, you said good things too. There's a story told about a girl who got for her birthday a book about penguins. And a day or two later, her aunt, who had given her the book, asked her, like, new? So what about the book? So she said, this book taught me more about penguins than I wanted to know. Brains and souls and interfaces, what do we want to know about them? What's it got to do with life anyhow? And more particularly, what do they all have to do with the Rebbe's Yahrzeit this coming Shabbos on the 3rd of Tammuz? So, first of all, a little word about preparing for Gimel Tammuz. Some of you may have been there yesterday when I said some of this, so for you it'll be a review. If I asked you how long Hashem's appearance at Sinai took, what would you figure? How long did the whole thing take for Hashem to say the Ten Commandments? When they read in the Torah, Ten Commandments, how long does it take? About 3 minutes. How long would it take God to say them? Okay, it was quite exciting. There was drama, and people are fainting away and being revived. And all right, there was some. How long do you figure? 10 minutes. Now imagine if all we had were those 10 minutes of Hashem's appearance at Sinai. And we were living for the past 3,000 years, we're meant to live with that as our drive, our inspiration, our mission statement. Imagine, those 10 minutes would have been forgotten half an hour later. It's because of the build-up, 49 days of counting, the Omer, and as the Rebbe would often point out, that we don't count down 49 days to go, 48 days to go, we count up, first day of the Omer, second day of the Omer, which means, what's the difference? A countdown means that there's just a certain amount of time that has to elapse before the event happens. But those intervening seconds, minutes, imagine Apollo's about to blast off, 10, 9, what do you think is happening during that 10, 9? Everything's ready to go, it's all systems go. We just need a couple of seconds of delay to triple check, to whatever. It's a time lapse. That's all it is. But when you count up, it's accomplishment. I'm a 49th of the way there, 2/49ths of the way there, until I'm fully there. Because of the 49 days of counting, because of the more intensive 3 days, the 3 days of preparation. So when Hashem finally appears for those 10 minutes, we are primed to receive His message. And then it makes a lasting impression. Whatever we want to integrate, whatever we want not only to experience, but for that experience to become part of our mindset, The only way we can do it is by priming ourselves. So that when it happens, we are so fully in tune with what is happening by being primed that we're able to integrate the experience and become part of it. So we're sitting here several days before Gimel Tammuz because we want that on that day we would be able to reconnect, recommit, rededicate, re-inspire, re-understand once again the importance of the Rebbe's message and mission and how it relates to us. But that's not going to happen on Gimel Tammuz all at once. On that day, we're going to gather and we'll talk and we'll verbring and we'll, and the men will have an aliyah to the Torah, and everybody will write in a pan, a pidyon nefesh. I'll leave that to the shluchim to discuss when and how it's going to happen. So whatever is going to happen, it can't all happen together on the one day. In the one shot. If we prime ourselves before, then when it comes, we absorb it. So in that spirit, we're talking today about brains and souls and the interface between them, because one of the most important elements in the Rebbe's teaching and message and legacy is to know who we are. Let me tell you a story. It was approximately 1948-1949, thereabouts. A young man who had studied in the Lubavitch Yeshiva in Crown Heights under the tutelage of the previous Lubavitch Rebbe, Rabbi Yosef Yitzchok Nishmo Seiden, he had left Yeshiva. He was now married, and he was in the rabbinate in a town called Maplewood, New Jersey. Now, I know this place because I learned in a yeshiva nearby in Newark, New Jersey, and I would walk almost every Shabbos, about a half an hour, 40 minutes, to read the Torah at that rabbi's shul. His name was Reb Sholem Ber Gordon Oliver Sholem. Reb Sholem Ber Gordon, fresh out of yeshiva, idealistic, completely committed to Yiddishkeit, he comes upon this congregation in Maplewood. He's rearing to go. On Shabbos, he notices that cards magically appear around the shul. They mushroomed. They must have sprung up like fungi from under the earth. They weren't there at the beginning when he came in the morning to shul. And in the course of the service, what an amazing place. It sprouts mushrooms, sprouts cars. So he decided, okay, next Shabbos he's got to give a sermon about Shmirah Shabbos, keeping the Shabbos. And he really lays into it how important, how Shabbos is, we gave our lives for Shabbos, how more than the Jewish people did, kept the Shabbos kept the Jewish people. All right. All right. He really gave it. Next Thursday night, he went shopping in the new area, and he notices in the supermarket that lots of his congregants and other Jewish customers are buying things where the kosher label is very hard to see. Whoops, the meat, hello. I mean, there's a kosher counter, but there's not that much traffic there. There seems to be much more at the non-kosher traffic at the counter. So he decides this Shabbos he's going to deliver a sermon about kashrut. And that Shabbos, he gets all fiery about kashrus is the bonding glue of the Jewish people. They've always stuck together and eaten together wherever they are. This is what kept our people pure. Tetris, tetris, tetris. He really gave it. And so the third and the fourth, until the president said, you know, Rabbi, this is America. You're going to continue the way you are, you're not going to have anybody to talk to. So Reb Sholem Ber, the Rabbi Gordon, goes back to New York, and he looks to go in for an audience to the previous Rebbe. He was old and frail by then, more frail than old. He could barely speak. And Reb Sholem Ber goes in, and he says, Rebbe, what do I do? If I tell them, they don't want to hear. If I don't tell them, what am I there for? And the Friedrich Rebbe, the previous Lubavitch Rebbe, Rabbi Yosef Yitzchok, who also had a special connection with the date of Gimel Tammuz, but let me finish the story, told him, were you ever in a Turkish bath? Strange things happen there. People sit on these benches, and other people come around with brooms, and they whack them. Now, said the Rebbe, imagine someone came up to you on the street and took a broom and gave you a whack. What would you say? What would you do? You'd probably hit him right back. But here, people get whacked and they say, ah! And they want more. What's this? He said, if you pick a person up, talking about going up higher and higher on the benches with the steam, with the heat, if you pick a person up and you warm him up, and then you whack him, he says, ah, and he asks for more. If you tell him, Shabbos, kashrus, that's not the way you do it. If you pick a person up, do you know who you are? You know that you are no ordinary being, you are a neshama. If you warm him up, that your actions are not only for yourself, they connect you with generations that have gone before. They connect you with generations to come and inspire generations to come. If you pick someone up and you warm him up, and then you whack him and say, no, Shabbos, then he says, ah, and he wants more. That has been a message that he lived with and that inspired me in all the years. I have a hard time telling people what to do. Most of the time, they know what to do anyhow. They don't really need me to tell them what to do. If they ask a shayla, a question, then I can answer them. But tell them what to do when they know in any case what to do feels A, dumb, and second of all, demeaning. So I'm not good at that. So I was always inspired by Rabbi Gordon's story. So what I look to do all the time is to lift people up and to warm them up so that they are in touch themselves with their better sides, and that better side demands to be expressed. You do things that conform, that match that better side of yourself. So that story always impressed me tremendously, but it all comes back to what? To knowing who and what you are. Without that, who are you demanding of? On whom are you making demands? Somebody you decided that there's a code of Jewish law, that there's a regulation, then you have to conform to regulation? Leave me alone. I don't want to be told what to do. But when you make a person realize who he is, And you say, and you want more. If that's what I'm meant to do because of my stature, because of the great being that I am, then I want more of it. Because that'll express that greater self that these actions bring out. So a key message in the Rebbe's teaching, and in fact, what the Rebbe called his signature mission statement. I'll tell you about that in Mitzvah Hashem tonight. You have to leave some for tonight, right? So just to whet your appetite, you will find out tonight what the Rebbe himself defined as his signature mission statement. You don't often find people saying, this is what I'm all about. But in this case, he did. So come back tonight, I'll tell you what it is. But it also relates to this idea of knowing who you are. Knowing who you are nowadays is getting increasingly simple and increasingly difficult at the same time. There was never a time when anyone was able to peer inside the human brain and see its different parts. This part of the brain makes that tick, and the other part makes you laugh, and the third one makes you remember, and the other one makes you your executive function in decision making. If you're familiar with the terminology, good. If you're not, don't worry about it. It's boring. It's fascinating, but the terminology is boring. So I'm not going to go into the terminology. But there was never a time when we had the tools with MRI and fMRI to actually look inside the brain and see parts of the brain at work as they are at work, functioning, lighting up, blood flow changing, chemicals coming and going. There was never a time when we were able to do it. The big mystery of a human being was encased inside of his skull. And nobody knew what's going on. He didn't even know that the steichel is in the brain. Kidneys, it was heart, it was this, it was that. So all kinds of things that people thought at different times, that's where the seat of intelligence lies. Imagine kidney transplant would be gewaldig. You get a new mind. So the discovery that it's the brain, that the seat of intelligence and personality and all that in science is fairly recent. 150 years. Interestingly, in Kabbalah and in Chassidus, it's a couple of hundred years that it's identified. Even right brain, left brain, it's clearly there in Kabbalah. You may even have come across it. Chochmah and Bina. Right brain is Chochmah, left brain is Bina. It's been there. But scientifically, it's a fairly recent discovery. That's on the one hand. So that simplifies it. On the other hand, the more people poke around, the less apt they are to find a someone. There's a whole lot of mechanics going on. Neurons are firing and transmitting, and they're hooking up with one another and forming new relationships. But the self, if there is a self, they argue about that too. Is there somebody home? But if there's a self, it's so elusive. Having such a hard time finding, they dig deeper and deeper and deeper, like digging inside the atom. And you dig, there's an atom, and inside there's the electrons and protons, and you dig inside, and you find quarks, and you dig inside, and you find some other mysterious, almost unknowable thing. Where's reality? And likewise, in digging inside the human being, okay, I see exactly what makes you tick, but who's ticking? Where is that ticker? So at the same time, it's more simple and more complex and elusive. And some prevailing theories say that there's really nobody home. It's just that when you get a chemical soup together in a certain way, it produces certain reflexes and nerves and chemical reactions that we call the human brain. I find it strange. I mean, it's almost like an article of faith. If someone told it to me logically, I think he's off the wall. But it is, in some circles, the prevailing scientific theory that all we are is an amalgam of chemicals and nerves and neurons and whatever, and in under the right conditions, they all function spontaneously. And from that, they want to extrapolate that there must be somewhere else in the universe, somewhere where all these chemicals came together, all these elements came together, so presumably there would be that kind of intelligence somewhere else. So now there's a big project, what's it called? SETI, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, and they're sending out messages figuring that if there's an intelligence out there, they would probably be able to decipher the messages which we are sending out, because if they have the right chemicals in their brain, they'll figure out what our chemicals in our brain worked out as the proper way of communication. All based on that supposition. So let's see what Torah says, let's see what Chassidus says, and most importantly, what the Rebbe says. Most importantly for our purposes now, before Gimel Tammuz, what the Rebbe says. I had a teacher when I was in yeshiva. He was already an older man. He didn't come in that often. But when he came to teach, there was an extra dimension of light. He wasn't that articulate. He couldn't put his ideas in many good, clear words. But in the Chassidic parlance, you saw the oir, you saw the light in what he taught. His name was Rabbi Yisrael Jacobson, Olav HaSholem. Rabbi Yisrael Jacobson had come to the United States from Russia in the 1920s. One of the early Hasidim, at a time when America was treif, absolutely chazer treif, no good Jew would be caught going to America. That's a one-way ticket out of Judaism. So there were a very small handful of Hasidic Jews who emigrated from Europe to the United States. Rabbi Yisrael Jacobson was one of them. Rabbi Yisrael Jacobson was wanted for the draft in the Russian Tsarist army. Being in the Tsarist army for a Jew, especially an observant Jew, was a sentence in hell. The anti-Semitism of the average Russian was bad enough, but when you added the religious element to it, it was gefährlich. So if the Jew was obviously observant and he's keeping Shabbos and he's wearing tefillin and he's doing davening, it was intolerable. They made his life a hell. So Jewish teenagers did everything they could to avoid the draft. What Rabbi Jacobson had done to avoid the draft, I don't want to show in my own body. We don't do that. I'll just show you where he did. He had something pulled in his wrist so that his fingers were permanently semi-opened. Imagine going like this, but that was it. It was frozen. So he got off the draft. He tried to reverse the operation, but couldn't. So that's the way he went through life. So whenever he explained things, he explained like this. Today it's become very popular among Israelis. You know. But Rabbi Jacobson used to talk like this. And he said one morning in a shir, Vos meinst du? Can I borrow that bag? Whose bag is it? Huh?
We hope it's not an anonymous pack.
No, right. Okay.
I'm going to say yes.
Vos mento. A nefesh in a guf. A soul in a body. If you are cats in a zak, like a cat in a sack. Imagine you had a cat in here. Okay, what are you going to see a few seconds later? Whoop! Whoop! Said the Rebbe Yisrael, if what means to the zak tanzt, the god tanzt. Who's jumping around? The sack is jumping around. It's the cat jumping around. So what do you think? Hashem installs a soul in a body. So is it like putting a living cat into an inert body so that the soul, the life force, does its thing and the body jumps around with it? No, in that case, the cat tant, the zak tant. The zak tant, the cat tant. So you think it's the body dancing? It's the life force jumping around, but the body's still dead. That's not what we believe. It's not the, not only not what we believe, it's not what we intuitively feel. We are alive. Every bit of every fingertip, everything from head to toe is alive. It's a human being who is alive, and that's what makes all of us part of one organism. This finger and this finger are not just neighbors. They're part of one larger whole. That larger whole is the alive human being. God forbid, when a person dies, these two fingers are just neighbors. They have nothing to do with each other, really. They're two pieces of flesh which happen to be near each other. No connection. Maybe attached, but there's no real connection. We are alive. Our bodies are alive. Our flesh and blood and sinews and nerves and muscles are alive. They're not living things. You can find them on a counter. I don't want to get gross. But, you know, in a shop. The equivalent. But once the soul is within them, they are alive. And you know what? We say this every time, several times a day, every time we use the toilet, when we come out, we say a special blessing, thanking Hashem for our functioning system. And the concluding words of that blessing are, Baruch Ato Hashem, blessed are you Hashem, Roife Kol Bosor, healer of all flesh, Umafli La'asois. And he who performs amazing things, wonders. You know where those two words, umafli lasois, come from? They come from an extraordinary vision of, you remember Samson? The other half of the Delilah part? Samson, who was a Nazarite and supernaturally strong, and Hashem sent him to help the Jewish people fight off the Philistines. His birth was a very unusual birth. It was preceded by a visit of an angel to his mother. The angel told her, you're about to conceive. The child that you're going to give birth to will from the womb, from the day of his birth, be a Nazarite. A Nazarite, as we read 2 weeks ago in the Parsha, he doesn't cut his hair, he doesn't drink wine, he doesn't come into contact with the dead. Those are the three basic things. Your baby, from the moment he's born to the end of his life, will be a Nazarite. And that will be the source of his superhuman strength. So I want you, said the angel, to be careful even during pregnancy. By the way, another one, huh? Another one of these examples where Torah prestes by centuries, medical science. Don't drink wine. don't eat grapes, because that's going to go through the umbilical cord. That will feed your child. He's the Nazirite in the womb. So careful, anything that a Nazirite mustn't eat or drink, don't you, mother, eat or drink. Okay, message done. The angel departs. How does an angel depart? He waved goodbye? No. The angel said as follows. He told the father and the mother. Manoach was the father. I forget the name of the mother. Eishes Manoach. Okay, Eishes Manoach is the mother. And he told them, make a fire, offer an offering to Hashem on it. Now here's the catch. As they made the fire, the angel went into the fire and he disappeared within the flame. What are the words that the Torah used to describe this process? Umafli la'asois. Hashem made an amazing thing. That what? That the angel fused with the flame and disappeared, went up with the flame. Umafli la'asois. Those two words, which we say every time we're coming out of the toilet, sometimes we're washing our hands, sometimes we're drying them, and we're getting out with our business. If we stopped and thought about those two words for half a second, we'd be bowled over. Umafli la'asois. In our body, Hashem is performing that same miracle, that same amazing wonder that he performed for the Manoach and Eishes Manoach when they saw the angel go up. Here it's working the other way. The soul is coming down. It's fusing with the body. The same thing in reverse. In the case of the angel, he's becoming dematerialized. He's disappearing within that flame. That's the mafli la'asois. In the case of our bodies, our neshama, which is spiritual, is becoming kind of materialized and fusing with the body. When a neshama fuses with a body, that's mafli la'asois. That's astonishing. That's the most spiritual of things, fusing, bonding, becoming one with the most material of things, the human body. And in a way, the human body is more material even than animal bodies, but that's the subject for another time. They fuse. There's no cat in a sack. The cat has nothing to do with this sack. He would jump out if the zipper was open. He just happens to be in the sack. So when he jumps, the sack jumps. But they have nothing to do with each other. A soul in a body fuses with the body. And the term that Hasidus uses to describe that fusion is mohus and metzius. Metzius is substance. Mohus is the who. Who behind the substance. Within the substance. That's the definition of that substance. Take an example. If a mother strokes a child like that, would you describe it as a finger going horizontally across the back of a palm? Is that the way you would describe it? It's a glet. It's a stroke. It's a caress. The definition changes. It's not just the action done for a different person. I could be rubbing an itch, or I could be giving a caress, but it's the same movement. Right, left, right, left. No, the caress is a different kind of movement. It is redefined by the meaning, by the purpose, by the feeling behind the movement. It redefines it. The soul redefines every inch and every cell of the body. It is no longer a cell inhabited by an energy force. It is the human cell. It's alive. It's human, and it's different, unique, different from anything else. Where does that main fusion take place? That bonding, that mafli lasois. Where does it take place? Mainly in the brain. That's the point of contact where the soul fuses with the body, most particularly with the mind, with the brain, with all of its processes. Now that gives us a different perspective on what's going on in the brain. Are you going to find the soul if you pick at the brain? No. It's like coming into this room. I don't see any electricity. It's in the bulb. I take the bulb, I break it apart, I still don't see electricity. I take it into its component part, I still don't see the electricity. You're not going to see it. That's not the way it works. But while the current is flowing, it's electric. Poking around in the brain will not give you a who. It'll give you a what. It maybe give you a how. But it certainly won't give you a who or why. That is from a dimension beyond what poking around can do. Bottom line, if you say, who am I? I am soul. That's what Mahus and Messias means. A redefined, I am not a hand which is alive because I have a soul, a living being. I'm not a head or a foot or any part of me which is alive because I have a living soul within me. I am soul. Soul is alive. And that's why I'm alive. Where do we see this? So let's take an illustration and then we'll come back to our point. I think that you all know that maybe not. Okay, I'll dwell on it for a moment. We are taught in the first portion of the Torah. Now, the Gemara says everything has to have a muzzle. The portion of Bereishis, the first portion of the Torah, is the richest, richest portion of the Torah. Somehow it has a muzzle. We always skip it. In these schools, they skip it and they start from Noach. In our yearly lesson plan, Chayenu, who has Chayenu? I saw in the Chayenu, you have about a day to go through this massive, big portion because it's Simchas Torah and you have to cram it into a day's learning. It's a muzzle. But what a rich parsha. Everything to do with good and evil, everything to do with mankind and creation, it's all there. So there it describes the first sin, the sin of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. I'm not going to go into what the sin was and what kind of tree it was and how it happened. I want to talk about the aftermath. Two things happened as a result of the sin of the tree of good and evil. One, mankind needed clothing. Before that, they didn't need clothing. Exactly why is also a matter of a discussion, conjecture, medroshim, which we won't go into, but they didn't need clothing. After the sin, suddenly fig leaves, garments, multi-billion dollar industry called fashion and garment industry. It's a big deal, but they didn't need it before they sinned. Second consequence, more important, man became mortal. He dies. Before he ate of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, he could have lived on. But the day that you eat from that tree, said God, you will become mortal. So, question. First of all, what's the connection between the two? Second of all, how is he supposed to live forever if he hadn't eaten? And what does it mean? You ever see the, what's it called? The garment that covers the face?
A veil.
Huh?
A burqa, a veil.
The?
A veil?
Yeah, yeah, but Muslims wear...
A burqa.
Burqa, yeah. There is no Jewish equivalent. There is the Mishnah, which tells us exactly how many garments maximum a person can wear. Which means, if there is a fire, God forbid, on Shabbos, you're allowed to save the clothing you can wear on you. So it describes, you can have clothing on your head, on your hands, on your body, on your legs, around your neck. There are 18 different garments mentioned in the Mishnah. There is no garment on the face. Face is not covered. In Judaism, there's no such thing as covering the face, except a wife, when she's about to be married, she covers her face for reasons which we may talk about in a minute if we have time. But otherwise, there's no covering. When do we cover a person's face? When they're dead. Then the face is covered. What happened? When I talk to you, I look at your face. But what am I looking at? Am I looking at a piece of flesh? A nose? Am I looking at eyeballs? Hair? Eyebrow? What am I looking at? I'm looking at the you, the soul. That's who I'm communicating with. It's not a pair of lips communicating with a nose. It's person to person. Soul to soul. Where do I look to find the soul? The face. The Hebrew word for face is panim. And panim means inside. That's where your inside comes through. In your face. When you're alive, your inside comes through your face so forcefully that I no longer even look at the flesh, the lips. Of course, we could take notice if we want to, but in normal exchange, I'm looking at the mange, the you. Only as long as there's the you inside. When after 120 years, a person dies, there's no more you. It's gone into you world. Done a U-turn. So there's no one to look at. No one to look at. I cover. In lifetime, your elbow is not the you. An elbow without a you should be covered. A foot should be covered. It's not really you. Etc., etc. Face is you. That shouldn't be covered. That's supposed to be apparent. That's the real you. Now imagine a person whose elbow reflects his being like our faces reflect our being. Would he wear clothes? Of course not. Just like we don't wear clothes on our face. So it's not that other Mauritian Adam ran around naked. His whole being, his whole body was a face. And it all reflected him just like our faces reflect us. Of course, you ever see a soul wear a suit? If the soul is coming through, there's no clothing necessary. If the soul comes through your face, no clothing necessary. Clothing necessary when there's no soul coming through. So the two go together. When death was the consequence, then clothing is the consequence, because even when a person is alive, he doesn't completely come through in all the limbs of his body. Only the face is left of what was such a human being before this sin. Got it? So that's the idea, the clothing and the death going together. But why death, and why therefore clothing? Because there is something of a fracture. That complete fusion of body and soul, which Hashem intended should be the characteristic of a human being, when a person allowed himself to be dragged by the urges of his body toward that which was sinful for him, it created a fissure, a slight separation between body and soul, and therefore he was no longer the mensch that he was. He therefore couldn't pass on all of his characteristics to his progeny. Adam HaRishon was complete in every way, bodily, soulfully, godly soul, but he couldn't pass that on to his progeny because there was a separation within him. He wasn't all there. He couldn't pass it on. That is why suddenly he can die. You ever see a soul being taken for a funeral? Souls withdraw. They're not buried. So if a person is all soul, if every inch of his being is soul and it reflects through every inch, then he's going to live like the soul continues to live. Unfortunately, ever since the sin, we become mortal. And bodies wear out. And after 120 years, it's gone. And the soul lives on. So they go different routes. But basically, the meaning of life still is, and this is what you see in a face, fusion. Fusion of body and soul. In the brain, it's fusion of neurons and chemicals with the presence of Hashem's life force, the personality behind you, the you, in those neurons of the brain. Now, why is it important? Why do I want to know that? Any suggestions? Why do I want to know that? Fusion, yes, no, atom, tree, clothes, cat, sack. Why do we want to know this? Because we need to know that when we feel a tug toward being more than just day-by-day survivors, whether of the rat race or survival, you know, struggle for survival. When we feel a tug for meaning, when we feel a tug for spirituality, when we feel a gravitation toward Hashem, it's not someone else that we're following. It's not someone else's teaching, creed, belief that we are subscribing to, that we are following. That is us. We are being us. And on a simple, practical level, if someone comes over to you and asks you to put on tefillin, he's not asking you to do anything but what you are. If someone asking you to do a mikveh, to go to mikveh, to light a Shabbos candle, this is not some strange new practice that this rabbi came up with and he's asking you to subscribe to be one of the fold. That's you. If you could hear it, you would constantly be aware of your own body crying out for that mitzvah. I'll tell you a little story. It's a famous story. But I'll tell it to you with a little twist. I think you all know the story, just tell me so I can fast forward, the story of the Akedah. of Avraham Avinu offering his son as Yitzchak as an offering on the altar, and at the last moment Hashem intervenes, sends an angel, says, stop! Yeah, you all familiar with the story? Good. There's one phrase there which I want to talk about. Yitzchak is on the altar. He's bound, hand and foot. He's there on top of the wood on the altar. Avraham Avinu is about to sacrifice him. And at that point in the narrative, the Torah says, Vayishlach Avraham et yodoy. Avraham stretched out his hand and took the knife in order to sacrifice his son. Why is it important that he stretched out his hand? Is this like a literary device? You slow down the action at the dramatic point. He stretched out his hand to take... If the knife was right next to him, and why wasn't it next to him? What's the point of the stretching? Rabbi Levi Yitzchok of Berdichev and another Hasidic Rebbe, Rabbi Yisrael, Kozhnitzer, less well known, but contemporaries. You know about Rabbi Levi Yitzchok of Berdichev? Besides being a wonderful intercessor for the Jewish people, he was a genius. He was an absolute genius. And his writings, some of them, we have Kedushas Levi. So he writes there as follows. We are told that Avraham Avinu kept the entire Torah. How did he know? How did he know what's right and what's wrong? So our sages tell us, Rav loy hoyaloy, he didn't have a rabbi to teach him. Aviv loy limdoy, his father didn't teach him, his father was a terach, who knew nothing, he's an idolater. But his inside became like two rabbonim, and they taught him wisdom. His two kidneys became like two rabbis, and they taught him wisdom. Your kidney have a degree? Your kidney have smicha? Anybody? Who's learning from kidneys? Okay, kidney is a figure of speech. But what does it mean his kidneys became rabbis and they taught him? A little louder?
Life blood.
There was an instinctive, what we would call gut. Our sages are calling kidneys. A gut instinct. When he was about to do something, if he felt that he's gravitating toward it, that's good. That's what Hashem wants. And I'm going to do it. If he felt repulsed by it, something is wrong. He was so in tune with Hashem's will that his inside instinctively, intuitively felt what's right and what's wrong. And he could rely on those instincts to know this is what Hashem wants, this is a mitzvah, that's what Hashem does not want, it's an aveda, it's a sin. So he knew the Torah before it was given. No one told him. Is that ideal? Is that wonderful? It's wonderful, but it's not ideal. But before we go on to why it's not ideal, what's the one time that Avraham Avinu could not trust his instinct? When Hashem told him what to do. Then he's not relying on instincts, he's following Hashem's instruction. When did Hashem tell him what to do? When Hashem said, take your son Yitzchak, bind him on the altar, offer him up to me. Okay, I have a clear instruction. I'm meant to offer up Yitzchak as an offering to Hashem. So this time when Avraham Avinu's hand goes out to the knife, it doesn't reach. He has to vayishlach, he has to stand forth. his hand. His instinct told him, don't do it. His instincts were right again. He wasn't meant to do it. He wasn't meant to slaughter Yitzchak. God forbid. The whole thing was a test of his loyalty, that he's ready to. But he wasn't meant to take that knife and slaughter him. His instincts were right again, but this time he overrode his instinct, because as far as he knew, he had an instruction. That was also part of the test. Vayishlach Avrohom es yodoy. Avrohom stretched out his hand. Other situations, he didn't have to stretch out his hand. His hand went where it's supposed to go. You ever watch a dancer? If you can see the hand move or the leg moves, that's a big problem. You ever see a sportsman throw a ball? If you can see the hand moving, that's a very schwache thrower. You don't see the hand. You see the motion. The hand disappears. When you look at a painting by a master painter, you don't see lines of paint. If you look at a child's stick figure man, lines, hands, feet, head, you see lots of lines. But you look at a master painter, there's no lines. How else do you make a picture without lines? Of course there's lines. They disappear into the larger figure. Hands disappear into the larger movement when the movement is graceful. Avraham Avinu never had to stretch out his hand to do anything good. His hand went. You have to catch the ball, your hand goes to where the ball is. You don't stretch your hand there. Except this once. It's a beautiful state. And we're probably wishing, I wish I had that instinct where my hands would move the way they're supposed to. My eyes would look where they're meant to go, etc., etc. We don't live that kind of existence. But inside, underneath, there is that eye that wants to look where it's meant to. It's concealed. We're meant to choose. We're meant to follow Hashem's instruction. That's what Matan Torah is about. And I'll just throw in one more tidbit. By the Bardichever, Bardichever says, we stay in the Haggadah. Had we stood before Mount Sinai and not been given the Torah, Dayenu, it would have been enough. What do you mean, Dayenu? Why else are we standing at Mount Sinai if not to receive the Torah from Hashem? Why would it have been enough? Said the Bardichever, when they stood at Mount Sinai, they had purified themselves to such a degree that their instincts were in tune with what Hashem wanted. They would have instinctively followed what Hashem wanted, like Avraham Avinu did. That wasn't the plan, though. Hashem wanted to instruct them so that they would choose to do it. They would not follow instinct. But had we stood there at Sinai and reach that level where intuitively and reflexively we follow what Hashem wants, Dayenu, it's quite nice. It's happening. It's actually happening, but under the surface. And why is it happening? Because the soul is us. No cats and sacks. It's fused with us. We want, our body wants, every cell within us wants that which the soul wants, because that's the real us. So that's about the interface between body and soul, but most particularly between mind and soul. And the reason that all this search for the workings and the mechanics of the brain have to take into account that all this is about an underlying you. And when we know what that you is and who that you is, it makes everything, all our behavior, that much more simple and natural and flowing, so that we'll be able to, instead of having to resist and fight, we'll be able to follow that which is naturally us, as we are taught by the Torah. And that's what the Rebbe wanted to see in every single Jew that he's involved and aware of that who that he really is inside. Thank you. Any questions, I'll take after.